This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. I had the opportunity to sit down with Alan Murray, the CEO of Fortune Media and the curator of Fortune CEO Daily. Many of us enjoy reading this every morning to catch up on business news of the day, corporate governance, and also learn about some of today's most newsworthy CEOs. Alan has spent his entire career and life as a journalist, working across the media spectrum. He served as the Washington, D.C. bureau chief for CNBC. He was the deputy managing editor and executive editor online at the Wall Street Journal, where he spent three decades. He was the chief content officer of Time, Inc., and he also led to the rapid expansion of the Pew Research Center's digital footprint as president of that organization. It's certainly easy to call Alan one of the most important journalists of our time. He's the author of four books, a Moorhead Scholar at the University of North Carolina, a Luce Scholar, and he holds master's degrees in economics from the London School of Economics. He's a member of the Gridiron Club, the New York Economics Club, and the Council of Foreign Relations, and he also serves on the Governing Council of the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Alan is also a regular speaker on the main stages of places such as Davos and Aspen, where he interviews key business leaders, so it was certainly fun to reverse the roles and place him in the hot seat for once. I really enjoyed this conversation with Alan, and I hope you do too.
Yeah, so it's been a very strange 24 hours, and it has been for business leaders too. I've noticed that there's been a lot of call on business leaders to take stances within their company, to take stances with their lobbyists, with their congresspeople. And you had a lot of your business contacts and CEOs reaching out to you at all, wanting to get their voice in the media about this?
Yeah, I have. People tend to send all those statements to me. And Matthew, this is something that is relatively recent. I've been covering the intersection of business and society for now four decades. And I can tell you, until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, when you had something like this, a controversial issue, a sharply divided public, doesn't directly affect the bottom line of the company, I can tell you the default position of every CEO was to hide under the desk. Say, I'm not going to talk about it. I mean, I'm a journalist, right? It was my job to try and get CEOs to talk about controversial issues, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. They say, stick to their knitting, stick to their things that directly affect their bottom line. I think it started to change. It's evolved over a decade. I think Mark Benioff was probably one of the first back in 2015 when Indiana passed a religious liberties law that was seen as discriminating against gays. And he spoke out and said, we're taking our people out. And then you had sort of a growing spate of it. Ed Bastian, who runs Delta Airlines, based in Atlanta, Georgia, took the discount away from the National Rifle Association after the Parkland shootings, even though the majority of the members of the state legislature in the state he was based in are members of the NRA. Bank of America did it when their state passed public, you know, transgender access to public bathrooms law. And then, of course, with the Charlottesville riots, you had Ken Frazier of Merck. And all of a sudden, this became a thing. But I can tell you, as recently as 7 years ago, you wouldn't have seen any of this. They would have said, no, we're not going to get involved. And it's a really, really interesting change in the way business operates.
It's interesting that the cases that you mentioned are cases that are more on the left, in a sense, you know, making a – I don't mean this – I think that they're good statements, but they're politically correct statements in a way. They're pro-diversity. They're pro-inclusion, something that could be seen as something that would get good publicity. We've seen public cases like Chick-fil-A, and there have been cases of CEOs that are associated with the right. Do they tend to be quiet to the media?
No, I think it's a little different than that. I don't think this is all of a sudden a bunch of CEOs woke up one day and said, hey, let's try and get good publicity by embracing liberal.
I'm not even saying it is. I was just curious.
Yeah, I think here's where I think it's coming from. What has changed pretty, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this and trying to analyze this, what's changed pretty dramatically over the last few decades is the importance of human capital in the fundamental value equation of the corporation. I mean, 40 years ago, if you looked at the balance sheet of a Fortune 500 company, plant, equipment, access to oil in the ground, those were the sorts of things that determined value. Today, if you look at the value of a corporation, it's intangibles, it's intellectual property, it's a whole bunch of stuff that has to do with people. And so I think this has really been driven by employees who say, by God, I want to work for a company that's doing good in the world. This is very important to me. You need to speak out on this. So I think you're seeing people speak out on the issues that matter to their employees. And what I see on the flip side, on the conservative side is, I even see some of those companies saying, hey, we got to rethink what we're doing. I was contacted by Coke Industries a couple of years ago where they wanted to get their story out because they felt they were doing good in the world, but getting bad press. So I think it's pretty much across the board.
It's going to seem like it's going in a different direction, but media, you've already mentioned how CEOs have changed in their relationship to what they'd like to communicate to the media over the last 7 years. And maybe how that's linked to some polarization as well. I tend to think of media companies as the most important ones being the ones that you've run and worked at, Wall Street Journal, Pew, CNBC, and now, of course, being the head of Fortune. But now there's this intersection of the largest companies in the world being media companies in a way. Facebook, Google, I think of as a media company. And how has that changed the way that information is about businesses and businesses you trust and social responsibility gotten to people?
Well, it's changed everything. Let's put business aside for just a second. I mean, this is obvious, right? But you say Facebook is a media company. I agree Facebook is a media company. But until fairly recently, they would deny that vehemently. And it was all tied up in this notion that, no, we're a technology platform. We're not a media a company. And it allowed them to escape any responsibility for the stuff that they were putting out there. When I was at Pew, which was 5-6 years ago, we did a study on media consumption, and that was the first time we pinpointed that 50% of Americans were getting news from Facebook. Now, think about that. I mean, there's never been any media organization that could claim they were reaching 50% of Americans. I mean, you had three networks, you had a bunch of national newspapers. So it had by then already become probably the most important source of information with no controls whatsoever. No way of knowing what was good information, what had been fact-checked, what was done by reporters who had tried to find out what people on the other side had to say, all the things I was, 40 years ago, trained to do as a journalist. None of that happens. And some of it's just purely made up or done by Russian troll farms. So I think that's had a huge effect. It's actually been very disturbing this past week because I normally write about business, not about politics, but I've had to write about politics because it has what's happening this week has a huge impact on business. And I was just going through my email and it's just profoundly disturbing that we're dealing with intelligent people who have a completely different fact base than I do or than other people do. And you don't know where it comes from. And we've never in my lifetime, You know, I was talking to someone about this the other day. Maybe it was like this during the Civil War. I wasn't around then. But in my lifetime, we've never had a period like this.
But I think it even goes beyond what the issues with being pro-Trump or not pro-Trump. But for instance, you know, I have a tech company that works in hard tech, and one of the things we work on is doing tests for the COVID vaccines, for instance. And I've had people come to me and say, you know, enormous things I would have thought, you know, 10 years ago would have been conspiracy theories that would have been thrown out very, very quickly about COVID and about the vaccines. And they pull up, you know, YouTube videos of some channel that's some YouTube channel and show me, how can you say this? Look, this person's genetics have been altered. And I am sympathetic to it in a way. If you have, you know, YouTube that is owned by one of the largest companies in the world, that is, it's really hard to everything looks like you have tons of choice. You're looking at YouTube, you think, well, there's millions and millions of YouTube channels, but it's all the same company that is allowing you to say that to be equally footed as journalism.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how to deal with it.
No, I think it's a very hard thing to deal with because, look, we applaud consumer choice, right? We all believe in consumer choice. We want consumers to choose. And that's really what's happened to media. When I started out in media, there wasn't a lot of choice. You know, the national news was pretty much controlled by a dozen organizations, right? You had two wire services, you had maybe three important national newspapers and three networks, and they all spent too much time having lunch and dinner with each other. And their worldview was probably way too narrow and closely defined. What we have today is the polar opposite of that. You can get anything you want at any time, but the problem is there's no quality control. We live in a world where consumer choice for information is, you know, absolute. Is that a good thing? Particularly when people just don't seem to be very good at distinguishing between what's factual and what isn't. And so everybody gets to choose their own facts. That's hugely destructive. And that's kind of where we've landed this week.
Yeah, I think that I've had this feeling about ad models that I'm curious what you think. Clearly, that's an old tried and true model. You guys have had ad models and others have, but it's very different in the world of social media type ads. Content that is filtered, with no sign that says paid content. Yeah. It's filtered based on some opaque thing that is AI optimized. How can traditional media, whether it's an ad model or a subscription model or whatever it might be, it compete for that type of money?
Well, first of all, I think when you talk about an ad model, it can't compete. It just can't. I mean, what, 80, 90% of the new digital advertising every year goes to the two companies you just mentioned, Facebook and Google. So there's just not enough money left. I mean, the companies that make money off of ads in the digital world, off of digital media, are doing evergreen stuff or highly viral slideshows or maybe user-generated content. But if you talk about old school journalism, where you have somebody who goes out and spends a fair amount of time reporting to try and get as close to the truth as they possibly can, that's a fairly expensive thing to do. And the ad business no longer supports it.
All right. So advertisers aren't paying for journalism anymore.
And to be honest, I don't think most advertisers really cared about journalism.
No.
Just in the old days, you know, if you weren't in the newspaper, you didn't have any way of getting to people.
Yeah, it gets to the point then of who really cares about it. When do you get to the point when nobody even knows what journalism is? How close to that are we?
Feels like we're pretty close.
It does.
It feels like we're pretty close. I mean, I was just going through my own email, and I've got a pretty well-heeled, intelligent group of subscribers for the newsletter. I write the top of a newsletter every day, and I love the group. It's a smart group, but I mean, there are a lot of people there. I don't understand it. I mean, several people who say, look, the evidence of fraud in this election is clear. I said, well, wait a minute. I haven't gone out there personally digging up all the evidence, but we know the Attorney General of the United States, who was appointed by Donald Trump, said there's no substantial evidence of fraud in the election. We know that the Department of Homeland Security, again, people appointed by Donald Trump, said there was no substantial indications of fraud. We've had 2 months for the president to take what evidence he had to various courts. Something like 60 different courts have considered this. Not a single one provided evidence of fraud. And yet there are intelligent people out there, in large numbers of them, who think there is clear evidence of fraud in the last election. I had someone who suggested to me today, you know, we really do need to have a commission to settle this. I said, well, if 60 courts and the president's own attorney general and the state governments of every state, many of the states in question being run by Republicans, can't solve it, why is some commission going to solve it? There is no evidence.
Who could possibly be on this commission? Well, you've now weeded out everybody else.
It's mind-numbing, but these people feel very strongly and feel entitled to their facts.
But, you know, they're not all young people. And I say this because we all were around during the Bush Gore, where this really was down to a few votes that went to the Supreme Court. There was a peaceful transfer of power anyway.
Yeah.
Was actually a disputed thing. People lived through that,
right?
What do they realize? Do they have a sense that it's the news that they're consuming? Do they have a sense that what is the big thing that has shifted that would make people think that this is a contestable election in that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Matthew. And Bush v. Gore, I was Washington bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, and we set up a satellite bureau in Tallahassee that covered that for that month. And you were talking about a couple hundred votes. You know, if there was ever a case for storming the Capitol, excuse me for saying that, but it would have been then. It was just a couple hundred votes, and they stopped the counting. What's so remarkable about this case is I would have expected, given 2 months to do so, that the president's allies would have been able to come up with more evidence.
Right.
Elections. You would think in just the normal course of things, you could find a few hundred or 1,000 votes here or there that just got screwed up. And they couldn't even find that. And yet there are, and by the way, the margin was huge. It was 4 million votes. And yet there are people out there who think this election was stolen. And what it says, is, and this gets back to the COVID thing as well, it's distrust in authority. They don't believe the authorities. They don't believe the system works to protect them. You see the same thing in science. They don't believe the scientists. Poor Tony Fauci, you know, who I've known for decades, is a great public servant, has been clobbered over the course of the last few years. And frankly, you have to say they've been given permission not to believe any of those people by the president of the United States.
Well, I mean, who am I to disagree with the person I'm interviewing? I agree with you about the president of the United States being deeply irresponsible about and having our distrust of authority being eroded. Don't disagree with that. But trust in authority in general right now, whether it's scientific authority or political authority or journalistic authority, I'm kind of sympathetic to not knowing who to turn to.
Yeah.
It's to our earlier point. And part of it being during COVID especially. So we won't talk Tony Fauci. He's a friend of yours, and I respect him as well. But scientific leadership during COVID has gone from don't wear masks to wear a mask. It's gone from there's been so many different views and that on how to handle things. And it's that very rarely does the actual science ever enter into public discourse. And I don't know. I don't know how we say when you have how you choose now. So how do you find an arbiter of right now? What would you advise to a young person?
Well, let me say a couple of things. One is, like, I think this mask thing is a bit of a canard, right? I mean, people said don't wear masks in the early days of the pandemic when there was a shortage of masks and they wanted those masks to be available to the to the people.
It's still dishonest, though. It's still dishonest. If somebody says to me, it doesn't matter to wear a mask, even for good purpose, like even if their purpose is to have somebody else, how do I believe that they're not doing that again for other issues?
Well, you're a scientist. Don't we have clearer science today than we did in April?
We do, but we had that science in April. Huh.
That gets to my second point, which is when people cynically abuse the willingness of others to accept bad information, that obviously erodes the situation even more. And if that's what happened in masks, then I guess that's a fair point. It's certainly what's going on in politics. I mean,
yeah.
I would be willing to bet that 98% of the Republican members of Congress, if not 100%, believed that there was no evidence of fraud in the election. And yet, for their political self-interest, they bought into this notion that we have to question it, rather than what you would hope your leaders would do, which is step up and say, you know what? I trust the Attorney General of the United States. I trust the Supreme Court of the United States. The evidence doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah. And now, just because today there are people that are standing up against the president after there was a takeover of Capitol Hill, it's a bit too late to stand on principle at this point. It's good it's happening, I guess. But even then, there still seems to be people that are standing behind the president. But so.
Yeah.
It doesn't show great courage anymore.
But man, I don't think this is what you intended to have me on to talk about.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
All we can do in this conversation is make enemies.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Sorry. I'll try not to do that. Yeah, I guess that my point was actually not to do that. I would like to figure out a path forward to not be polarized. You know, it's not so much to me about Trump or yesterday. It's about what you're saying, the last 7 years, or how
do we get there?
How do we get there?
I mean, this, by the way, is why I went to the Pew Research Center. You know, they call themselves, said, we're not a think tank, we're a fact tank. I thought, this is an organization that is trying to assemble a core basis of facts upon which we can have an intelligent debate. I think they do it as well as anyone, but it's hard. It's very hard.
You know, who does something really well? You do in general. The CEO initiative The World Economic Forum work that you do, the Fortune's Most Powerful Women, you do it because business leaders are the leaders often, right? So it's important, not just because there are workers but this is the economy, this is thought leadership, it's really everything, and you are trying to bring discourse together. Have you noticed, Fortune's also had many different owners over the last several years, right? Has there been any change that you've noticed, and has the ownership of the company made a difference to your ability to work in this type of, to be able to carry this wonderful agendas forward?
Well, ownership matters. And it's very different being owned by a businessman who lives in Bangkok, Thailand, than it is being part of a giant company with 24 titles like Time Inc. It gives us much more flexibility, much more freedom to chart our own course. And so all of that is good. I think in terms of our evolution towards a more purpose-driven organization with a clear agenda to make business better, I felt completely supported in both environments. But the other thing I should say is, you know, it's not like I woke up one day and said, you know what, I'm going to devote myself to improving the social impact of business. It's I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist. I literally started when I was 9 years old, all about sort of observing and learning. And I got to this point more from observing what was going on in business. There was a very big change that took place. I think it started back in the last recession, and I can walk through some of the key turning points, but it's tied to this notion we were just talking about of companies' value being based in their employees and employees wanting to work for companies that were doing good in the world. So I think there's been a pretty dramatic turn, which is what led us to create the CEO Initiative, which is a community of CEOs focused on positive impact on society, and led us to create the Change the World list in the magazine, and has been really a core of a lot that we've done over the last 5 years.
Early in your career, you're mentioning being influenced by business. Were there journalists that influenced you early on that you just looked at as a kind of gold standard or a mentor that you worked with?
Yeah, I had a wonderful mentor at the Wall Street Journal. He's still around, Paul Steiger, who I worked closely with pretty much for 20 years. And what makes Paul so special is just the enormous integrity that he not only has, but that he put into all of us who worked for him. There was no game playing with him ever, either in terms of how we dealt with each other in the office or in how we dealt with stories. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I get so taken aback at the cynicism that people have about how the media operates today, because it's so far from the fundamental values I was taught by Paul Steiger.
Well, I mean, I think we sometimes tend to forget what a gold did. There actually was a golden era, in my opinion, but I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I mean, if you look back in history, there was a lot of media problems, right? Maybe, you know, go back to Civil War, Revolution. I mean, there were some, you know, a lot of media by, I don't know, maybe between this, I don't know, the 60s and until recently, there. It was pretty amazing in some regards. I think there should be some nostalgia. Do you have that feeling?
I think that's right. There was a professionalism of the media, particularly in the United States. It's a little less true if you go over to the, you know, the tabloid culture of the UK, for instance. But particularly in the US, there was a professionalization of the media. There was a an agreement upon standards of reporting. You know, you don't report something negative about a person or an organization if you haven't gone to them and asked them to comment on it, to give their side of the view. You have rigorous standards for corrections. If you do something wrong, you correct it. Basic stuff, you know, but you don't report something off a single source. You make sure that you have multiple independent sources. And I think all of that was pretty well ingrained. And there was also an independence from the editorial. One of the great things about being at the Wall Street Journal for many years, as I was the complete independence between the news pages and the editorial pages. I mean, in fact, we were often at war with each other, not just independence. And I think all those standards were a good thing. It wasn't perfect. The critics who, and you know, this was Roger Ailes' great insight in creating Fox News. The critics who said, "Wait a minute, the worldview of all of you." Back in those days, there really was something called the mainstream media, and the worldview of the mainstream media was seen as a little too narrow and too biased. A fair criticism. When people say mainstream media today, I don't know what they're talking about. You know, because the media is so diverse. And so who's the main, and the biggest cable network is Fox. I mean, so who is the mainstream media?
Right. Right. No, I have become especially, and I've never worked in journalism and never thought about it when I was young I took it for granted. You know, the New York Times would arrive, the Wall Street Journal, I would read both and be interested. You'd know that there was a slightly different take on certain things. But I didn't question journalistic integrity per se. I mean, that would never came to my mind. So I've found myself going back over the last few years and really checking myself to see if things really were better. And it seems they are. Or like I went back and I watched.
Or was
you know,
it?
I watch Buckley. I mean, even you know, I watch Buckley and Gore at the 68 Democratic Convention. I do like. I just for it's just amazing to me sometimes for fun to look at what people watched. And
well, I think
to.
I think it probably was better in some ways because they had functioning business models. you know, look at what's happened. I mean, I saw these numbers just the other day. If you look at community at city newspapers around the country, daily newspapers, the employment, the number of journalists working at those newspapers has decreased by 50% in a decade. So the point is there aren't as many people. They don't have the time to do the same quality of reporting that they did. So in that sense, I think there's clearly been some deterioration. But the other thing, as you say, that's deteriorated is people's trust. I mean, I the senator in Alabama, whose name I'm going to forget, but the Washington Post did this amazing piece of reporting showing that he had preyed on underage women fairly systematically over a number of years. And they had on the record sources, and they went when somebody said this happened in his judicial chambers on such and such a date, they went to the courthouse to check the logs to make sure the person making the accusation was actually in the courthouse on that date. Really, as a journalist, when I read that piece, I said, "Oh my God, they have this cold. It's all the facts on the record sources. This cannot be disputed." And the majority of people in the state of Alabama did not believe it. They simply rejected it because it came from the Washington Post.
So, wow, a piece that was well researched
Anyone trained in journalism, anyone trained in journalism would tell you this is about as solid as it can get. So I think that we've been trained to, or either we have been trained or we haven't been trained to know what, to be able to discern what's factual and what's hearsay or made up.
So we've talked about distrust of authorities, distrust of even good authorities, scientific authorities, good journalism, even from time to time. maybe more than time to time. But early in the conversation, you were speaking to social responsibility of business leaders, CEOs, and how there appears to be more, at least in some cases. First of all, is there more than there was early in your career, at least? Maybe not historically.
I believe there is, yeah. And you're right to go back before the beginning of my career. People talk about a similar period after World War II. And you can find these fine old companies like SC Johnson that just have these great family values that have been there from day one. But yeah, I think something pretty profoundly has changed. Look, what happened in the 70s and 80s, and I think it was caused partly by that period of economic stagnation, there was a, I wrote a book on this, it's called Revolt in the Boardroom. There was a war against corporate leaders feeling that they had gotten lazy, they'd gotten complacent, that they weren't looking after the interests of the people who owned them. And so there was an ownership revolt. I mean, that's where the raiders, the corporate raiders, people like KKR, I mean, the great book that a couple of my colleagues wrote, Barbarians at the Gates, was an example of this. You had activist shareholders coming in and saying, wake up, you people are, you know, losing to the Japanese, you're letting your company decline, you've got to wake up and do a better job delivering value to us, the owners. So you had this period in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s where delivering value to shareholders became the most important thing. And by the way, that's when corporate compensation changed. CEOs started getting paid in shares or various equity schemes, because the idea was that would align their interests more closely with the interests of the owners. It's an enormous influence. And of course, the famous Milton Friedman piece that was published in 1970 that said the social responsibility of business is to make a profit for shareholders, period. That's the way the system works. And this kind of reached its peak in the 1990s. So that was the period I grew up in and got used to. And it really started to change after the last recession, just a sense that markets weren't working the way they were supposed to. Bill Gates gets a lot of credit in my mind. He gave a speech in Davos at the World Economic Forum in 2009, maybe, where he talked about the need for a creative capitalism. And then you had John Mackey of Whole Foods talking about conscious capitalism, and you had Mark Benioff talking about compassionate capitalism, Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School talking about shared value capitalism. All of a sudden, everybody was putting adjectives in front of capitalism, which was clearly a sign that there was a feeling among business that we weren't doing this as well as we could be doing.
It's great, you know, great examples of amazing leaders who have done this. And I don't have any numbers. You probably will know this, but it's interesting how you talk about the 1990s as a time of alignment with shareholders. Am I right that CEO compensation is at a record high for being disparate from the lowest paid workers in the companies?
Absolutely. I mean, once upon a time, the CEO, now we're talking about my career, the CEO might have made 30 or 40 times the average wage. Today, it's 300 times the average wage. But that's been driven by the move to give them equity compensation, which was an attempt to tie the CEO more closely to the interests of the CEO more closely to the shareholders.
Okay, so that hasn't been broken yet, even though you identified as a 90s thing. Shareholder alignment still continues. Okay.
The people are still largely paid in equity. I mean, I hope there's some reforms happening on that front. I'll give you one example. Share buybacks. Some people think share buybacks are a bad thing.
You think they're a good thing?
I think it depends on the case. I don't think they're either good or bad. It depends on the case. But what I am quite sure is bad is that if you as a company say, hey, I have all this cash and I don't really know what to do with it, And so I'm going to give it back to my investors because they may be able to find other more productive investments to put that cash in. That's fine. But then you shouldn't let the resulting stock appreciation increase your pay. I mean, you're basically admitting failure.
Yeah,
you're,
totally.
You're admitting failure. You're saying, I don't have good use for this money, so I'm going to give it back to you. That should not be the cause for a 30% increase in your pay.
Yeah, no, I completely. I think about it. It is a very interesting time when you look at Silicon Valley dynamics. Do you think of sort of how venture tech model type CEOs differ from more traditional, or I guess the big companies of the early 90s, the 80s, or just the, other parts of your career. And, how does that affect social responsibility?
It's funny you ask that, because when I was first offered the job at Fortune, 6 years ago, I went to some friends who I trusted and said, what do you think? Do you think I should do this? And a couple of them said to me, no, you shouldn't go to Fortune, because Fortune is the magazine of big companies. And all the exciting stuff that's happening is in small companies, startups. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, think Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple.
Those little.
So, you know, that.
Not that these big companies like Kodak.
So it's, I just think of those conversations with great amusement now that those guys have become titans. But there is this weird dynamic going on, and it's only gotten worse in the last year, where, the traditional investing model where you get an interest rate or a regular rate of return is kind of fallen apart. I mean, the value of money has fallen to close to zero, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in the search for, you have all these people who in the 90s got used to this notion that they should get an 8% return or a 7% return. And so in the search for yield, everyone focuses on growth. And that has caused this mad rush of money into the Teslas, the DoorDash, whatever, companies that may not, WeWork, companies that may not be making any money right now, but at least they have a promise of growth in the future, which you're not going to get from a blue chip. I think that's really distorted business incentives in a pretty peculiar way. I mean, maybe Tesla will ultimately live up to its stock market valuation, but right now it's worth more than all the other car companies put together. And so what you have to believe if you invest at that valuation is that it will just totally dominate the automobile future and that none of the other companies will figure it out. I think that's a pretty extreme view to hold. It's not the most likely outcome.
It also, though, speaks to the either romanticism or pragmatism, depending on how all of these things turn out, about founder-led businesses. Certainly in the case of Tesla, the car is amazing, but Elon Musk is kind of a hope to a generation in a sense. It kind of goes beyond the car. You've spent time speaking to so many CEOs. Is there a fundamental difference between a founder-led business, and do you think that there should be some type of based on at least history, if I were to look at who you've talked to over time, is it a good data point for being able to track what the future success of a company is if it's a founder-led business?
I don't have the data.
No, your experience, data.
There's a lot of stuff in Silicon Valley still, in my view, that traces back to Steve Jobs. And I'm not sure Steve Jobs was typical of anything. Right. At all.
I think I'm not sure Elon Musk is probably either.
Elon Musk is not. That's right. So there are plenty of examples of founders who screwed up their companies as they moved up the growth curve. It's not not difficult to imagine at all. And think about Satya Nadella, who took it over from the founders and has caused Microsoft to soar again. So
now he's brilliant. Yeah,
he is. But he's not a founder.
No, exactly. Yeah,
I have not been convinced of the Jobsian founder thesis is the best way to go.
So we talked about a mentor of yours in journalism, but also how you were inspired by business leaders. And you've mentioned some business leaders that you think are really great. Do you remember early in your career, a business leader, a CEO, whether you knew him or didn't know him, that acted as either a spiritual guide mentor, actually was an actual mentor who was a leader to you?
Well, this may not be an answer to your question, but the very first paying job I had was when I was 14 years old, and it was at a tourist trap near my home. I grew up in Tennessee on Lookout Mountain, and there was a place called Ruby Falls, which if you've ever driven through Chattanooga, you've seen 100 signs saying "See Ruby
Falls." Yes.
And I was I don't know why I was able to do this when I was 14, but I was a parking lot attendant. And one of the things we would do, the parking lot was right off the highway up Lookout Mountain. And there was a big sign there that said Lookout Mountain Caves and pointed into the parking lot. And we were instructed to like park a van in front of the caves part. And then so that you would think you were going up to Lookout Mountain. Anyway, why am I telling you this story? The guy who owned Ruby Falls, which was very successful at the time, would once every couple of weeks pull into the parking lot, get out of his car, put on a white hat, just like the white hat I had on, and stand out there and direct cars to park in the parking lot. And that had a really profound influence on me. That leadership means contributing to the organization, but making people understand that anything they ask you to do, they were willing to do themselves. It's a stupid anecdote, but I was 14.
Oh, not at all.
And it sticks in my mind. I think of that all the time.
No, yeah, not at all. I completely get that. In fact, I was thinking about Tesla stock hype as well, by the way. And I started listening to recent interviews of Elon, and there was a Wall Street Journal video interview, or I may have been from a Wall Street Journal conference, and he was asked about giving advice, CEO advice, and he said, spend less time in conference room and more time on the factory floor, something along those lines. And, I guess it's a kind of big version of that in a sense. But, if maybe there's some beautiful hope that, that your mentor with the white hat from Ruby, will lead us to have is a scalable idea. That maybe that will account for reaching new heights as a bit for business leaders that maybe have stocks that you consider overvalued now. I wonder what the correlation to something like that is, or if it just is great culture and great leadership and a great way to live your life.
Well, I'm going to get the name of the book wrong. One of the most famous, was it in Search of Excellence that talked about level 5 leaders?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
One of the interesting things about that, on the one hand, and this gets back to the Steve Jobs example, and this is why these are complicated questions. On the one hand, to build a great company, you have to be hugely ambitious. You probably need a certain degree of hubris, right? Because you have to envision that you can do something that will really change the world. Yet on the other hand, what that book showed was it also requires a degree of humility to understand that you can't do it on your own, and that you have to both respect what people can do for you and be willing to learn from them. That's where this whole idea of servant leadership comes from. And I really believe that. And you can't caricature it, because you do have to have Steve Jobs, Elon Musk type capabilities to take on the big task and succeed at it. But you also have to be willing to put the task above the needs of your own ego. And that's where so many leaders fail.
Do you think that, you know, in your role as a leader of a business yourself, you know, I think of, you know, not only you dealing with the biggest business leaders, you are a big business leader.
Matthew, I'm a little business leader.
Well, you're big in the world of your business is great influence too, I should say. I mean, do you get out on the factory floor, so to speak?
Yeah, at Fortune? I mean, this is why I write every day. I write 300 right. words at the top of the CEO daily.
That's why we get the daily.
That is my version of my 14-year-old boss. Because and the reason that was important, it's not just so I think I'm going to write to show them I write. Well, first of all, I love to write. Okay, but actually, the main reason I did that was because Fortune was in the middle of a pretty big culture shift. Under Time Warner, all the Time Inc. magazines pretty much just made magazines. Fortune's website was given to CNN money. All the video stuff was given to Warner Brothers Studios. And so they had created this subsidiary that was just in the business of making print magazines, which was a death sentence. So when it spun out 5 years ago, we had to start a website from scratch. And you had a culture of journalists who were accustomed to writing 5,000 words once a month, who had to write 300 words twice a day. It really required a complete mind shift. And there were lots of different strategies to making that culture change happen. But one of them on my part was say, well, by God, I'm going to write every day. So they understand that I'm not asking them to do anything unreasonable when I ask them to write every day.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's fun for you. And so
I love it, except in weeks like this when people send me notes saying "go to hell," cancel my subscription, or this morning I got a selfie of a person's hand with the middle finger extended. That was the sole response to my post.
Well, I find this is really a sad thing, because I would have never looked at Fortune as, oh, that's a statement for one. You know, I would have thought it, like you said, about business leaders of the past. I would have no idea to associate Fortune as being a polar of any kind of political agenda. It's just at all.
And to be honest, you know, in terms of my personal politics, which I'm not a journalist covering the news anymore, so I'm pretty upfront about. I mean, if I showed you my presidential votes over my adult life, you would think I was nuts. It's like a broken electrocardiogram, because
yeah, me too.
I voted for as many Republicans as I have for Democrats, and I've gone back and forth as I found faults with them. And I had a mentor in Washington, died a few years ago, but he was one of his name was Richard Darman, not beloved by everyone who worked with him, but I had a great affection for him. He was a budget director, deputy director of the Treasury. But he said to me one time, he said, you know, politics should be like golf. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, generally, you're better if the ball's in the middle of the fairway than you are if it's on one side or the other. And I believe that's right. I would have, you know, I didn't have strong feelings one way or the other about the candidates in Georgia, but I would have preferred an outcome that left Republicans in control of the Senate, so that there was at least some hope that they would try to restore the ability to have sane conversations about practical solutions that aren't based on political aspirations.
Yeah, I know. I try to explain that to my 15-year-old daughter, and she's only grown up now and during the most polarized time that I said, like, no, it's crazy that you can't have friends with, you know, she's in a very liberal community in Brooklyn, New York. It's like, no, of course, you know, of course you should be having conversation with people that have different political beliefs. Are you crazy? And then she gets mad at me. And I was, well, no, this is really what is happening.
Yeah. And this, by the way, is part of the evolution of business, because, as you know, people who are in the world of business have to be pragmatic problem solvers. You have to. You've got to deliver results. You can't do that without being a pragmatic problem solver. And so what's happened in the political world, I mean, when I started reporting, business defined the right wing, right? It was the American Enterprise Institute, was because they, you know, believed in property rights and capital and so forth. But what's happened over time is the polarization and the political theology is set in. Business has become the center because they believe in science. They believe in pragmatic problem solving. So take an issue like climate. Business is way to the left of the Republican Party. Take an issue like diversity and inclusion. Big business is far to the left of the Republican Party. They really define at least the center, if not kind of a progressive center on some of these issues, because the issues are practical issues that have to be solved.
That's so interesting. I had never looked at that, but now it makes sense, certainly, that you say that. You know, and I guess it is, being, you know, close to 50 years old myself, I still think of, you know, businesses' agenda to pollute more because they are industry, right? And I'm not even condemning the past by saying that. I mean, there was, if you go far enough, you know, you were creating industry. This was something. It was a decent debate, not if you're talking about polluting, but about creating jobs or building an economy. But it was certainly a right wing thing. Now you, that's so interesting.
Yeah. So I don't think it's just, I mean, when we started this conversation, you referred to business leaders embracing progressive ideas for kind of PR benefit. You didn't say it that way, but I thought that was.
Yeah, I kind of did. And I'm not sure why I did.
And I think
I regret it a bit.
I mean, there is some of that, but I think it's much more than that. I think they do it because their employees want them to do it. And they often do it because they believe it's in their long-term interest. I mean, if society falls apart, it's not going to be a good place to make money. if the climate burns up, nobody's going to make a lot of money. So if you think about the long-term, I've always felt that your statement that there are tons of things that business can do that are detrimental to society, but will help their bottom line, in the short term is true. I mean, I was in the C-suite of Time Inc. for its final days, and I can tell you there were a lot of things that happened there that were done to beef up the quarterly number to try and keep the activists at bay that were probably not good for society. But as the time horizon gets longer, the interests of society and the interests of the business tend to merge. If the temperature of the earth increases 4 degrees over the course of the next 4 decades, that's not good for business, right? If society breaks apart because of vast inequalities that have arisen over the last couple of decades, that's not going to be good for business.
Right. So civil wars take a while to get over. your town burning down from wildfires take a while to. Yeah, I love that perspective. You bring hope today to me, actually, but I do always love reading Fortune. I must say, because I do sort of remove myself actually from everything else and try to focus on what excellence is, you know, whether it's businesses. What may make me think about what might be skewed in one way or the other? Who are the leaders that I should look to? You know, regardless of, you know, my age, I want to look for mentors until I'm, you know, in my 90s. I mean, I you know, this is the great thing, is to be inspired. And certainly Fortune does that. So, I mean, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me. And I'm sorry if I started it on a strange tone. No, it's a strange time.
It's the topic of the week. Hard to avoid.
Yeah, but I do want to ask you one other thing. It just came to my mind when thinking about the Fortune 500. I did see that you had mentioned, you'd spoken about the number of Chinese companies that were on the list and how that might be a little bit different. You could put it into your words, than an American company due to state ownership, at least partial state ownership of Chinese businesses. Do you think about having, you know, breakouts into different types of, do you think of restructuring Fortune 500 based on that at all?
Oh, that's interesting. We haven't. I mean, look, there are actually two Fortune 500s. There's the Fortune 500 we publish in the spring, which is strictly U.S.-based companies. So in a sense, we already have.
Well, I guess you already do.
We already have one version. And then there is the Fortune 500 that we publish in the summer that is the Global 500.
The Global, yeah.
And so so in a sense, we've already done that. And my bias That's 5 years ago was to get rid of the U.S. one. So why are we doing this? But I don't know. I mean, you're right. We live in, talk about polarization. I mean, just, and I've spent, because Fortune has a business in China, and we do a lot of conferences in China, I've spent a lot of time there over the last 5 years. And it's just a completely different ecosystem, and becoming more different because of public policy difference and pressures, and the values are different. And I don't think we know how we're going to solve this tension in the years ahead.
Yeah, well, you'll have this interesting role of being you guys reporting on it, whether it's, but also in a way defining it a bit by having a global Fortune 500, by having business. You play an actual active role, not just a reporting role.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's interesting to watch, but I'll just give you one example. We wrote a lot, you know, last summer, IBM and then several other companies made the decision to pull facial recognition software from the market because they said it's just not good enough right now. And there are too many biases in the way it works for us to allow this product to be out there. So, okay, that's a value-based decision. Someday when we get it better, we'll put it back into the marketplace. But right now, it discriminates. You know, it can't recognize African-American faces as well as it does other faces and so forth. So at one of our conferences in China last year, a year and a half ago, we had a bunch of entrepreneurs present their products and gave awards. In fact, they all got a car, the winners did. One of the contenders was a company that had created gait recognition software, so which meant that they could look at a crowded intersection with hundreds of people, and without having your face, they could identify who you are. And they were super excited about this. But this is in China. Who's going to buy that company, right? What is that technology going to be used for? We know what that technology is going to be used for in China. So that's the kind of thing that suggests we're just in two very different worlds.
Yeah. Well, and it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds. I've done a lot of business in China as well, and there's some amazing things about it. And then there's things that just make us question who we are, which is what business does all the time, what customers do, what investors do, and certainly what you guys do for me. And But no, it's a great journey.
But thank you for having me on.
I really appreciate it.
I'm about to run to my next.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I mean, especially today, taking the time for me, I appreciate it.
I apologize. I talked on for a full hour, but you.
I loved it. I loved it.
Anything you want to.
Well, you just let me know what you don't like about it. No, I'll talk cut bits that make us hate.
I'll live by everything I said, but you don't. Oh, okay. You don't have to live by everything I said.
Oh, God. I know. I don't care.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Great talking.
Bye.
Bye.